Welcome to The Founders Table. I'm Kendra Brassfield, the CEO of Neolife International. And in this podcast, I'm going to be sitting down with Jerry Brassfield, the founder and chairman of the company, and asking him to share stories and life lessons that have paved the way for international success as an entrepreneur with a life's mission of making a measurable difference in people's lives. And so welcome to today's podcast. This is our very first episode of The Founders Table. And for me, growing up, the most valuable education I got, it didn't take place in school or even in university. The lessons that have been the most priceless in developing a mindset for success and wealth management, and then other critical aspects of being an entrepreneur, those mostly took place during candid, off-the-record conversations with my father and other successful people who have been there and done it. And so that's what we wanted to accomplish in this space, to invite listeners into those candid conversations. So let's just get started from the beginning. JB, can you tell us about what life was like for you growing up?
Thank you, Kendra. Life for me, as I think back on my early childhood, the things that stick out in my life were, my health, which was very poor. My family, we were a loving family. We were maybe a notch above the poverty line, but compared to the other kids that I grew up with and went to school with, we did not have as much as most people. And although I think of it as a happy time, I also think of it as a time of struggle.
And so in addition to the struggles that you had growing up in a household that didn't have a lot of wealth, what were some of the other health challenges that you struggled with growing up?
Well, of course, asthma was my main struggle. And I seemed to have a severe case of asthma, which threatened to kill me. Every year, especially during the growing season when the crops were in bloom and all the dust and pollen associated with the farming area that I was in, and the fact that I turned out to have an allergies as well to many things. All these things contributed to severe asthma, and that asthma dominated my life. So in my early childhood, I struggled.
And I've always really enjoyed when I get to hear you tell the story of a moment when you really had a wake-up call to fight for your life. And it kind of gives us a glimpse into just how bad your asthma was. Can you tell us about that night?
Yes, that stands out because I grew up in a Christian home, and my mother was the spiritual head of our family. And on one particular night, I remember that she called the minister of our church, Reverend Anderson, and asked him to come to our little house, and he came. I didn't know he was coming, but he showed up. I was sitting up in bed, and I was pulling for every breath. And she, of course, welcomed the minister in her home, and the walls were thin. So we could hear from one room to the other, you know, if there was talking. And so outside my bedroom that I shared with my brother Bob, there was a conversation with my mother, and I heard her say to the minister, apologize for calling him in the middle of the night, and saying the only reason that she did it is because she was afraid that I'm not going to make it, me, Jerry, not going to live through the night. And so I heard this, and that was definitely a wake-up call for me. If anything, it just made me more determined that I am going to try to survive during the night, you know.
That is a great story. And now, your mother did not stop at prayer, did she? Can you tell us about what she ended up going and doing that really was a turning point in your life?
Yes, my mother believed in prayer, but she believed that in taking action herself and that God would lead her in the right direction. And through networking with other people in the community, other mothers, one of her friends had a son who benefited from supplementation, and this lady friend introduced my mother to supplements, and she brought them home. These were things like cod liver oil that you take by the spoonful right out of the fish, so it didn't taste very well at all, and it was also multivitamins in the form of liquid vitamins. In those days, you have to keep in mind, this was 62, 3 years ago, it tastes so bad because they didn't even think about trying to cover the taste of the vitamins with flavor. So my mother forced me to take these. Every day she would call me to come to the stand in front of the refrigerator. Come on, you're going to take your, it's time to take your vitamins and your supplements. And then she would give me spoonfuls, as I recall, 2 spoonfuls of each. These are large tablespoonfuls of cod liver oil and 2 large spoonfuls of vitamins. And boy, this, you had to choke this down with water. And I hated it. And
that sounds kind of familiar. I can recall when you pulled the same thing on me with some of our early bars and tried to say they were candy.
Well, I remember you as a little girl. I remember I brought one of our bars home and I said, this is candy. And you ate a bite or two and you said, I don't like candy.
Thank goodness they have improved drastically and now probably can be passed off of candy.
Yes.
But so now your mom went out and at that time, I think if I recall correctly, hearing that nutrition really wasn't something that's mainstream like it is today. How was nutrition viewed back then?
Oh, well, my father viewed it all as medicine. And my mother, you know, more open-minded. And especially when I started to see progress. And my doctor was told that I was taking these supplements and that I was improving. And his response was, well, he's just outgrowing it now. So no credit was given to the supplements. But I learned over time that when I did not take the supplements, my asthma would return. And so as a result, that was always in my mind that I knew from testing from time to time, either through stopping, you know, intentionally or just neglect. I would go a short time without taking supplements and my asthma would return. So I learned late early on that I needed these supplements. I didn't know why, but I just knew that my asthma was under control when I took the supplements.
And now shifting a little bit, I just want to fast forward a few years, and I often find that people are surprised to find out that you weren't really formally educated in university. And I think you mentioned after attending only one half of one semester of college, you decided on a different course. And so can you tell us about that decision and what was going through your mind at the time?
Yes, I think that looking back on it, I maybe questioned everything around me more than I saw my peer group questioning. For example, I was studying at the local college. It was free, Porterville Junior College. And I went in to see my counselor. It was mandatory. And my counselor, I wanted to find out what I should be taking as course-wise. I was concentrating on engineering courses that would lead me in that direction. So a lot of math, and I asked my counselor what I could expect when I became an engineer, and he looked in his book and showed me some numbers. He said I could go to work for $400 a month, that I would maybe get $1,000 a month once I became served my apprentice, and of course that would be maybe equivalent to $5,000 or $6,000 a month now, maybe more. But I looked at him, and he could not give me satisfactory answers. And as I looked at him, I just saw a man that he was sitting there with his lunch pail, with his rundown shoes, with his suit that didn't fit. And I looked at him, and I just said, you know, this is not anybody I want advice from. And when he finished that interview telling me what I could expect, I walked directly from there to my locker, took my books out, walked into the office, set them on the counter, and walked out, got into my car, and drove away. And I decided that this was not for me. And not knowing exactly what I'm going to do, but I knew that that I was not going to be held back by people like this counselor in college.
Wow. Well, I imagine that took quite a bit of guts to do. Was that intimidating, like not having the formal education background or any know-how whatsoever in terms of being an entrepreneur at the time?
Well, after I walked away and went home, told my mother, told my father, and they started lecturing me, I became frightened that maybe I had made the wrong decision. So that set me back a little bit. But in my heart, I knew that I could make some money if I went to work and I applied myself. At the time, I was selling part-time as a delivery boy in a furniture store. Once in a while, getting a customer, I was making a commission, and on a monthly basis, my commissions were more than what the counselor told me that my pay would be after I finished my college education. So I thought I can always sell something, and that gave me some comfort.
And so, where did nutrition come back into all of this?
Oh wow. My brother Bob and I were standing in the front yard of our little home on Toma Avenue in Porterville, and Daryl Reeves, a classmate, drove up in his old junky car, and he said, you know, how would you like to earn some money? And I said, what is it, Daryl? He was younger than me by 1 year, and he was older than my brother Bob by a couple years. So he said, well, I can't tell you about it, but I'll take you somewhere and you can learn. I said, if you don't tell me, I'm not going. He said, okay, then you miss out. You're not going. Well, the curiosity got me, and I decided we would go over and have a very skeptical look. And that's my introduction to direct selling, and direct selling involving a line of nutritional products. That was the NutriBio company. And I ended up that night joining and buying one box to eat, one box to sell, I borrowed $50 from Bob, my younger brother. For some reason, I didn't have any money. And because I had a car, and I was my car was taking any income that I would make. So, and then my brother Bob also joined the same night, and I signed him up.
Did you pay him back?
He says he questions whether or not I paid him back. I know I paid him back because his very nature would not allow me to get away with a $50 loan.
I can also attest to that. So now, starting into this, you've always said that you are not about to let a lack of experience or education prevent you from succeeding. Can you talk a little bit about that and how you overcame those challenges?
You know, I overcame the challenges because I have to give credit mainly to my mother, who just had undying confidence in me, so much confidence in me, that when I lacked confidence, she made up for it. If I was sick, she says, "You're going to get well." If I was afraid of the future, she would say, "Everything's going to be okay." When my father would say, "Get these big ideas out of your head, you know, you have to remember where you're from, and you go get a good job." And my mother would say, of course, not in front of him, but she would say, "Don't listen to him, and he doesn't know what he's talking about." And she would say to me, "You can do anything you want to do." And what's amazing about that statement, now as I look back on it, is that she didn't even understand what I was trying to do, yet she was telling me that I could do it. And that type of just blind confidence and faith in me, her sickly son, just pushed me forward. And I cannot tell you how important that encouragement was to me. And to this day, I try to encourage anybody I can because I realize the importance.
And so I mentioned that this is going to be a candid conversation. So I would hate for us to leave out the fact that you are not a role model altar boy. Were you back in the day? You had a little bit of a rebellious streak. So for her to have this belief in you, that was a stretch, right?
Yes, I think that in today's world, if I grew up in today's world, I was one of those young boys that would have been diagnosed as ADD or attention deficit disorder, and I would probably have been drugged to calm me down. But here I was, just a boy full of mischief, bouncing off the walls. I mean, everything from painting the neighbor's house. I mean, found some paint, got a brush, and when the neighbor came home, I had painted as high as I could reach all the way around his little house. And that was these were the sort of things that got me in trouble. Bright blue.
So I guess we can imagine that growing up in a small farming community in Central California, you probably didn't have access successful entrepreneurs that you could tap into. But I know from an early age, you always told me, make sure that you find a few people that you really look up to as a mentor. And you don't necessarily have to know them, but you can learn through their life. And can you tell us about the mentors that you've picked throughout your life that have really shaped how you think?
Yes, I can go back to the early days when I was working in the small town of Porterville, and I was working at a Chevron station. And this gave me a chance to see a lot of characters come through who were customers. I would see them, the local doctors, the attorneys, the farmers, and I would talk to them. I learned they were my mentors in that I could see that they weren't the smartest people in the world. I saw them drink too much. I saw their bad behavior. And they mentored me in the sense that I thought, you know what, if these kind of people can be successful, I know I can. So that was an encouragement. In the early days, I would look for people that I wanted to be like. Earl Nightingale was a motivational person, and I used to listen to his tapes or his records and so on and read about him. And I remember him influencing my life. A quote that I've often think about is he said that the creator of the universe did not build a stairway leading nowhere. And he went on to talk about the promises that are in the Bible, and that how that we can all set goals and work our way in a direction. So later I was able to latch on to other people who were obviously successful, and they became my mentors. Some of them I've gotten to know personally over my many years of working, and to this day I still follow the teachings when it comes to investing and business and how to think about preservation of wealth. Warren Buffett is a mentor. I've met him numerous times. I've actually spent a lot of time with his right-hand man, Charlie Munger, and gotten to know, as you, Kendra, have met Charlie Munger and also met Warren Buffett. And, you know, if you walk up, they know you and they say, hello, Kendra. So these are important people in our lives.
Charlie has always, without a doubt, even in he's into his 90s now. Every time I see him, he says, I love going fishing with your father after a couple of trips.
Yes, we sat in a little boat on Venice Island, a little rowboat, and caught bass. And I can't tell you how special that time was. And I fished with him on numerous occasions. And I'm thinking of three different ones right now. But all enjoyable. And he's been blessed with a lot of wisdom. He also reads the Bible and has talked to me about the wisdom of Solomon. And if I were to pick a modern-day Solomon with wisdom, it might be Charlie Munger. You know, he's right in there.
I agree wholeheartedly with that. He's a very bright guy. Now, when you got started as a distributor, where was it that you decided to start sharing with people? Like, what kind of people did you identify?
I started with my circle of influence, and that, well, was Roy Vandrick, who worked with me in a furniture store. I started with Roy Phillips. He was my best friend in school, high school. Now these are people I talked to. I talked to many of my classmates and people that I knew. I was not successful in getting them to believe that I had stumbled onto something that was worthwhile. With the exception of Roy Vandrick that I worked with, he became a distributor. But I found that the people that were my age, 19, 18, 19, 20 years old, did not have money, did not have spendable income that they had to buy products. I needed to sell products. So I simply raised my target up. I said, who has money? You know, good question, right? If the people you're talking to don't have any money, a good question, logical question is, who has money enough to buy these products? And my mind moved up to 30, 35, 40-year-old people. And I started having success then.
And how did you share the products with them?
Oh, I'll tell you one story. It might might give you an idea, as I was working in the service station, I had a Ross Parker drove a new Cadillac. And so I thought, Ross has money, I know that. So he drove into the station, and I'm there in my white uniform with my name on it, all greasy because I had to work on lubing, giving lube jobs to cars, and opening up the hood and checking the oil. These were in the days when you did everything and put the gas in the car. So I talked to Ross about had this opportunity that I had stumbled onto, and I wanted his opinion, and I'd like to talk to him about it. He invited me over to his house, Carmelita Way. That's where all the rich people lived. I thought, if you were a doctor or an attorney or a CPA, or in Ross's case, he was a Prudential life insurance representative. So I went there, met with his wife and him. I remember her name, Cecilia Parker. And she was the manager of Montgomery Ward Department Store in Porterville, a very small Ward store. But I sat down at a table. I was so intimidated. Actually, as I pulled up in front of the house, I thought, what am I doing here? All of my fears just moved in on me, and I wish I had not even made the appointment, because I just felt empty inside. And somehow I was given the courage enough to go ahead and go in, sit down, very nervously explain what I was doing. They made me feel comfortable. After they listened to me, they looked on the volume discount chart, and they said, wow, let's see here. Well, I'd like to have an extra 10%, and in order to do that, they had to spend $1,200. So that order, I couldn't believe it when they said, I'm going to buy $1,200 worth of your product. And that sort of opened my eyes and said, well, this is the way to do it. You got to find people that have money.
And now, you mentioned something very briefly, but I want to go back to it because I think it's a really important point to hit on. When you initially approached him, you said you wanted to ask for his opinion.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yeah. I'm a young guy. I'm seeking the advice of an older person. I knew him just as a customer that when he came into the Chevron station, I would say, hello, Mr. Parker. Okay. And so he was always dressed in a suit and tie, driving his brand new Cadillac. So, Mr. Parker, would you give me your opinion on something that I'm doing and maybe something you would like to know about as well? And that curiosity just kind of got him, and he said, yeah, come on over at the house and let's talk about it.
That's great. It's amazing how most people just want to help. And so it's just as simple as asking for someone's advice.
That's right. I think that I've always given given a very direct approach or use a direct approach and not try to memorize, get fancy. My job, as it's turned out, was to set up a program, we'll call it, or a method of conducting the business that guaranteed that I would have several opportunities to tell my story.
And when you told your story, what was that like?
Well, I always started out by saying, getting them to know me a little bit, who I am. I wanted them to relax and not be afraid of me. And as soon as I felt a certain acceptance from whoever I'm talking to, I would talk about the product and then talk about the marketing business opportunity.
The basics.
The basics.
Pretty similar to
the basics. Yes, the basics. I don't think anything works except basics, you know. So
another thing that was touched on, in specifically that you had a job while you were building your distributorship.
Yes, I worked at that time for minimum wage, which was $1.25 an hour. That's, I got up to that. I started at $1, then I got $1.25. It's about equal to the minimum wage today when you move it into today's dollars. And that was barely enough money to kind of keep me going. So I think that this business is designed to be part-time until you build up enough customer and product flow through your network of people to make a profit, so you don't need that other job. But to me, I could not have survived without that job in Chevron Station.
And I know, even beyond your job at the service station, you had some other jobs. I think you mentioned earlier that you sold tires. And that actually served as a pretty good base of people to start tapping into.
Yes. At 20 years old, I will call it my 2021 right in there, I had moved over to San Luis Obispo and worked in a furniture store as a salesperson. And my direct selling job or business was part-time, and my furniture selling job was full-time. And then when they gave me the ultimatum saying either I quit my direct selling business or I quit the job in the furniture store, I quit the furniture store, kept my business because that was my hope. I could see that my furniture selling job was a dead-end street and that my business opportunity was unlimited. So, but I had to take another job. So I took a job at a Sears catalog store. And that means that you don't have the merchandise on display. You sell out of the catalog in those days. And they had a contest nationwide for selling tires, and I won the contest. So I sold more tires than anybody in the Sears operation. But I concentrated on it, and I just went around looking at people's tires and saying, you know, you're not safe driving on those tires, and let me fix them up for you. And surprising how many tires you can sell if you just go around looking at people's tires. So
you just find the need and fill it?
That's right. I looked for people who had tires that were look worn. And then I would just, you know, tell them about how unsafe that is to have their family in a car that has unsafe tires. So that was a very simple little presentation. What that did for me was keep me flexible so that I could go out and work my nutrition business right along with my Sears business. I was an outside salesperson, and so it allowed me to meet people and to talk about both.
And you've actually said that some of your success was helped by being a simultaneous car tire salesman because of the follow-ups. Can you tell us about that?
I always valued a customer, and I would never drop a customer and run on to the next person and then the next person, because I found it so hard to go through enough people to get somebody that I wanted to make sure that I gave them every opportunity to be successful. So so follow-up to me was just valuing the customer, valuing the prospect, and never giving up on them.
And so during the time that you moved out to San Luis Obispo, you decided you were going to build your distributor business. And can you tell us about your family life at that time?
I was married to my first wife, and I had Tony, my first son. My wife and I had had a little baby boy, and that was a very tough time. My family life at that time was a life that we struggled financially. I remember the ups and downs. I remember waking up and looking outside my house, and my car had a flat tire. I remember just going back in my house and being so down. My wife at the time was working at JCPenney's part-time. And I remember being in that house and almost in a fetal position, just curled up and afraid to get out of the house. So that was the low point. And I remember having a book, Think and Grow Rich. I read it over and over and got up the courage to get out of the house and get going again. These are terrible times, and I haven't thought about these times in a long while, but they were also times, as I look back on it, it was building my own character, building my, making me patient, you know, causing me to ask for God's help, reaching out, feeding my mind with positive thoughts. And all of these things contributed to personal growth, because when I got through that, I found that other people suffered the same way and I could help them.
And in addition to the financial hardships that strain put on your marriage, I can only imagine there were some other hardships as well going on in the background that probably affected the way that you were able to go out and build your business. And I know that not everyone around you was always positive. How did you deal with just negative inputs and a lack of positivity around you? Because sometimes we just can't control that.
No, that's right. Well, first of all, I have never been one to read all the newspapers, take all the negative press. If we allow ourselves to be exposed to negativity, to failure, to all of the bad things which sell newspapers and sell news stories, if we allow ourselves to be consumed by that and influenced by that, by just being in touch with it, we will gradually slide down. So I started just blocking out negative people. I found that as I go through people, if they spent 20 years being negative, that my chance of causing them to be positive was small or slim. So I would just walk away from those people and look for the bright person, the bright attitude, the normal person, I'll call it, the innocent person, and that had been so negatized by their life. I don't blame people for being negatized, but I do blame myself if I allow myself to be influenced by them. So I would just push it out and go on and constantly, daily feed my mind with good thoughts through reading the Bible, reading the trials and tribulations and trouble that the characters of the Bible endured, and then reading stories about people who had overcome very negative and almost impossible odds, and then thinking positive thoughts to myself, talking to myself, saying, you can do it, you know. And I had to do this before every presentation, before every person that I talked to. These things did not come easy in the early days. I had to just push through it. And I believe that, you know, I had my mother's prayers. I had my, as I gathered up support from my team, I sponsored people that were more capable than myself. And little by little, little by little, I can say that this personal growth started to happen in my life, but it was not without a struggle.
And I think we can hear clearly from that powerful story, this just the fact that you've always viewed, had an outlook on life where you've told me before, money is worthless, but people are priceless. And so money is only as valuable as what it allows you to accomplish and the good that it allows you to do in other people's lives. Can you just touch again on how important relationships are, not only in our business, but just in life in general?
I think relationships are really what's valuable. And relationships are built by reaching out and helping the people around you that you come in contact with just as a part of everyday life. Whether this be friends, whether this be new acquaintances, whether it's just someone that's in need. And I don't mean just helping financially. I mean that this word keeps coming back, encouragement. If my mother had just given me some money and said, here, I know you're, you know, I know things are tough and you're probably going to struggle. Here's some money, though. I would have spent the money and life would have been the same or worse. But she didn't have any money, so she gave me encouragement. As I have become more successful, and Kendra, I've tried to instill this in you and in your thinking, and I'm convinced that you have a very giving heart. I've watched it, and that is, we're here. Relationships are everything. Relationships with our God, relationships with our family, relationships with our team, our distributors, our customers. And these relationships take time to build, but they last forever if they're taken care of. And then the fruits that come from those relationships, the money, that's the profits. I believe that our job here is to take the money and to make life better for somebody, reach out and help others, whether it's health care, whether it's just with their immediate needs, rent, food, clothing, travel, education, anything we can help with. And give back. And I believe that that I've never felt better than when I'm giving somebody else something.
And that definitely shows in your life. As far where I'm sitting, I know a lot of the ways that you have reached out and just given really selflessly to so many people, but a lot of our listeners probably don't get that same insight because you're not one to come out and talk about if you just bought someone a car or if you just paid for their rent. But now it does happen. And how would you, what advice would you give to someone else who, as they're building up their wealth, and as they're being good stewards of those resources, what are some of the things that go through your mind before you decide to give to someone? Because I know you don't give to everybody, because it just would be impossible to help the entire world. We'd all end up with not much.
Yeah, right.
You right. just gave it. But you try to identify those people where you can really have an impact. Yeah. Can you speak to that and being
well,
a good steward?
You know, I believe that you know, God puts people in front of you in your life, if you feel you're guided to help somebody, then you listen to that. Sometimes it's a quiet voice, and sometimes it's pretty loud. But if you believe what I believe, that it's is better to give than to receive. By the way, I just read 2 days ago, I just read where they took a group, these are really smart people, these were Harvard students, okay, and they gave them each $100, two different groups, and they told one group to spend the money on themselves and come back. They told the other group to find somebody to give the money to. And when they brought the groups back in, the group that had spent the money on themselves were not happy. It wasn't enough money to do anything with. It was hard to find something that they could use for $100. In short, they were unhappy. The group that went out and found people to give the money to came back all happy. And I think, you know, of course, that's a biblical truth. It's better to give than to receive. Yet here Harvard people are trying to figure this out, you know, thousands of years later in an actual experiment. And so I find that when I give, I am so blessed in that process and so appreciated by the recipient of that, and I see the good that it does in their life on multiple occasions. I remember coming back from the winery. Okay, Kendra says I'm making too much noise. I'm fidgeting here.
Now you're touching your mic.
I'm touching my mic. Okay, Kendra, keep me on the right path here. Well, I was coming back from the ranch, the winery up in Clear Lake, and I was driving down the Highway 53. And I see people walking along the highway all the time. I just think, oh, well, you know, they probably deserve to be there or whatever. Well, I drove by this person, and that was a man, and he was pushing his shopping cart with a few things in it. And something said to me, stop and help him. So I tried to ignore this voice, and I turned around. I got to Lower Lake. I turned around. I went back. I saw him again. I thought, well, you know, I turned back around again and passed him again. And every time I tried to get away from this man, the voice got stronger. And I said, okay, I stopped. I pulled in front of him, and he came up, and I talked to him. He was not a derelict. He was not a drunk. He was not a drug addict. He was a man that needed help. I asked him what he needed. He said, well, I don't need very much. I'm just trying to get over to Lower Lake. I have a friend there that I could stay with. And I said, how much do you need? And he said, oh, I don't know, anything will help, but you know, I don't need much. And he told me he said, well, at the outside, maybe $200. He said, would that be asking too much? And I took my checkbook out. I said, well, as I'm starting to write $200, something said, write the check for $1,000. So I wrote the check for $1,000. I gave it to him. And That was it. Now, I've done that many times, various amounts, meeting somebody here and there on an airplane, another man on an airplane that was sitting beside me. He had no money, nowhere to go. And, you know, I believe that now these things are just in addition to the programs that the company supports through the Neolife Foundation, Family Foundation. And I believe that you can't give away and not be blessed somewhere. I believe that. What you hand out comes back. And so I think if we make that a cornerstone of our life, in our beliefs and the way that we conduct ourselves, that the world will be a much better place. And I'm just hoping that I can live long enough to prosper enough to just help more people. And that's my goal.
Very well said.
I think the first thing is, if you want to help people, we have to accumulate something. If it's going to be financially related, we have to be good stewards of what we have and then accumulate something so that we can help. Now, how do we do that? Well, we do that by not trying to be the world's top consumer of goods. You don't want to take your first money that you get ahead and buy new cars that you don't need, or a boat that you don't need, or a motorhome that you don't need. These things will just cost you money, keep you broke, and you will have consumed this money that maybe you've been blessed with. And you use it yourself as a consumer to make you feel better or make me feel better about having more things. And those things do not bring happiness. Happiness is when we are prospering and we are helping other people. That's happiness. And if we're going to help other people, we cannot spend all the money we are blessed by receiving. I think you have to be leery also of anybody who has something for you to invest in. Here's my thing, and I would like for you to invest your money, or I'd like for you to loan me money to do my thing. Just say no. No to loans, no to investing in other people's businesses or other people's ideas. This destroys relationships because the deals, 99% of the time, if not more, fail. This costs you friendships, ill feelings, and in reality, you don't help others. So I just politely say no and guard against that type of thing. Now, I've come to this conclusion or these conclusions by having done the wrong thing many times and seen the relationships destroyed, seen the money not paid back, seen the deals fail. And so, I'm lucky enough to have survived these things and gained possibly a little wisdom today.
So let's take a moment to talk about the subject of sacrifice. Because we know that if you don't sacrifice for the things that you want, those things will probably become the sacrifice. And I want to know, what were some of the sacrifices that you had to make early on in order to get to where you wanted to be?
Oh, I go back to the beginning. I mentioned that I sponsored Ross Parker. He had a new Cadillac. I had a junk car, a 1950 Chevrolet that was barely going. And I wanted to go hear one of the big distributors speak at a rally in the Bay Area. So we had to drive from Porterville 4 hours or so up to the San Jose area, 4.5 hours. And so I had to ask Ross Parker, can we take his car? And then I had to stay in the same room with him. And I was hoping that when I offered to pay for my half of the room, that he would say, "Oh, well, that's okay, I'll pay for it." He did. He said, "I'll pay for it." Other sacrifices were, I remember taking a distributor to another meeting. We had to drive, and it was going to be overnight. I timed it so that we drove all night and got there just in time for the meeting, and then drove back, so I didn't have to stay in a room. I remember driving my own car by myself and sleeping in the car, and finding a park that I could go and take a shower and do all those kinds of things. And even when I thought I was more prosperous, I remember staying in Motel 6 when it was $6. That's how it was named, and then sharing the cost of the room with somebody else. So these are things that I think of as sacrifices. And I guess the biggest one was being away from my family at times, having them understand that what I was doing was for the best long term. And I remember, eating at a McDonald's and getting a hamburger for 20 cents, 21 cents, 25 cents, and going and making one meal a day. So I remember these things and doing whatever I had to do. Had to stop and sell product before I could buy gas for my car to go to the next meeting. So sacrifices that you make are not so painful, not watching so much television, right? not making sure that you're home every evening for a meal when you could have an appointment. You sacrifice some of your free time, some weekends and things to work your part-time business, all knowing that in long term these will pay off, and there will be a time when your business will just support you and you'll have plenty of free time.
And on the same line of thinking for sacrifice, what were some of the sacrifices that you had to make, but looking back, you may have done differently?
I would have a better balance in my life between taking the time for quiet time, taking the time for, instead of being in such a panic because I was running from poverty, taking the time to spend more quality time with my kids, with my family. I believe that with a little less desperation in my life, that I could balance those things between my relationship with God, my faith, my family, my friends, and my work. Looking back, I know I could have done better.
And there's times that I'm sure all of us have regrets in the past, the sacrifices that we've had to make. But I think a really powerful example of how you were able to turn some of these negatives into positives, a powerful example of that was when I was in high school, and I can remember that you told me not too long before my high school graduation that you wouldn't be able to make it because of a Neolife trip that you were taking. And you did such a great job of showing me that it's not all about, the world does not center around your children, that what you are doing out in the world is making a true impact on the lives of so many people. And that helped it to put it into perspective for me to understand why I shouldn't be bitter about that. But it's a blessing to have a role model who is so passionate about helping other people. What are some other ways that you think a parent who is in this business and looking for their to have their children also have a love and passion for what we do, what would you tell them, some advice to others?
I believe talk to your children, include them in your thinking process. Kendra, you can reflect back, and I don't know how many years that I've been taking you and your mother to the Warren Buffett Berkshire Hathaway shareholder meetings, but it's many, many years. I think talking to your children about your business, including them in the discussions, answering their questions in a way that makes them feel that question is important, and trying to pass on your thinking in terms of setting goals, leading a being a positive example, leading by example. There's no leadership except leadership by example. So I think that so many times I see people who complain about their business and the shortcomings that they're experiencing and and giving excuses and all that. And they do this in front of their children. And by the way, this is just teaching by example that the children should do the same thing when they grow up. And I think if we can just be a positive example and then share in our learning experience, as we learn, let our children learn. As we find a book that's helpful, get our people, the people that we love, to read the book. I'm always giving a book to my wife to read, to Kendra to read, to my other children, and trying to be a positive influence in the development. And I think, Kendra, that you've seen that, whether it's conferences we go through every year in Beverly Hills, where the top business people in the world come to, and the books that you've read about the lives of wealthy people, the people that I've met and introduced you to, and that you have your own relationships with. I'm thinking of people like Baron Hilton, Hilton Hotels, Bill Tilly, Warren Buffett, Charlie Munger, Papa Doug Manchester. I mean, I can name so many people that I've gone out of my way to build a relationship with and then to bring you into that relationship. And to the point that you remember that when it came to these special dinners at Berkshire Hathaway, you got invited and I didn't.
I think they probably still want you back. So it sounds to me like if we were just to boil those principles down, it would just be present, right, when you're spending time with your loved ones.
Oh,
don't be distracted with the business.
Absolutely. So many times we spend time with our family, and we're not there. Our mind is off on some other situation. We're with our children, but we're saying to them, don't bother me. Don't make noise. Go in the other room and let me have a little peace and quiet. Well, Yeah, you can stay home every night. And with that attitude, you're really not spending time with your family. So if you can be present, and if you can communicate and let them know that you are there with them, not only physically, but mentally, spiritually, you're there. And then that's what I call really quality time. And that goes a long ways.